It may be a strange sort of question, especially because we're so busy nowadays trying, you know, to have lives. But stop and think about it for one second. Do you think some of what's going on around here nowadays is moral? Welcome to The Full Story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Now, don't think anyone around here is all high and mighty. An old friend of mine, a priest, once punched me in the shoulder and he said, "Don't even think about getting all pompous and righteous. We're all sinners." But the question some of us were having the other week is, have we gone too far? In the quest to fill the state coffers, have we thrown in the towel and said, okay, I have a problem with that, but we can make a boatload of money off of it. Today, we'll have a philosophical, a sociological, a historical, and yes, theological discussion about this. To start us off, we need to know what's being proposed nowadays by those running the show in Hartford and Albany. To tell us, we call on Sue Haig, who covers the Capitol, the Connecticut Capitol for the Associated Press, and Dave Lombardo, the Capitol reporter for the Albany Times Union. Hi, Dave. Hi, Sue.
Hello.
Hey.
Sue, I'd like to start with you. Let's start with what's taking place in Hartford. First, there's a push to legalize pot. Where does that stand in the legislature, and why is it taking place? Why is this happening now?
Well, right now, it's still to be determined whether or not it will pass this session. There are several bills that have gone through the committee process, and the proponents say that they need to try to take different parts of each bill and put them together into one final piece of legislation that everybody can vote on. This has come up for several reasons, depending on whoever you talk to. There are people that say we need the revenue and states around us are legalizing it. We should have a system in place as well. It's still kind of unclear as to how much money Connecticut could get from this. It depends on the tax structure, but there have been estimates about $180 million a year. There are other folks that say that we need to legalize it in order to make sure that people aren't being unfairly harmed by our marijuana criminal statutes. There are other folks that say, you know, we shouldn't be doing this because we're not taking a look at all of the health risks that come with this. So it's still, you've had like the medical societies come out against this. So it's very unclear as to whether or not it's actually going to pass.
Hmm. Dave Lombardo, Albany Times Union, New York State is also considering legalizing marijuana.
Yeah, this was something they had hoped to get done in the budget with negotiations not fully accomplished by March 31st. They had to kick it to the rest of the legislative session. And it's a lot of the same concerns that Connecticut is facing. I think there's a conceptual agreement that legalization is the right way to go, that the benefits outweigh the cons. But it's the implementation that's been the problem. Here we're looking at potentially $300 million in annual state revenue as proposed by the governor, who envisions a 22% tax, which would be on top of a per gram tax on marijuana growers. It's something that's going to be hotly debated over the next few weeks before lawmakers leave in June.
So in New York, they're talking about $300 million, and in Connecticut, they're talking about potentially $180
million. Right.
Is that right? A lot of the states have failed to hit their goals so far, with Colorado being one of the good examples where projections far exceeded what actually happened when they implemented their programs.
Dave, so the talk that you're hearing in Albany, is it just coming down to, look, Massachusetts is going there, New York people are driving over the border, they're going to Massachusetts, they're spending their dollars there, this is ridiculous, we should keep the tax dollars in New York State?
They're trying not to frame it as a revenue issue. They frame it as a criminalization issue. You know, we need to deal with the communities that have been hard hit by the war on drugs, and that's how they're trying to sell this. No one is really wanting to frame this as a revenue raiser, because then you get into this conversation about, well, what else should we theoretically be considering? What sort of sin taxes should we be doing? And at what point do we throw the baby out with the bathwater?
Okay, I know we're tight on time. A lot of things to cover here. Sue, I'm going to turn it back to you. What is Connecticut doing with casinos and sports betting?
again, another to be determined issue. The governor right now has is trying to craft some sort of a master deal that would not violate our compacts, our agreements with the Mashantucket, Pequot, and Mohegan tribes, because they claim that they have exclusive rights to sports betting, which is to be determined. But they right now have exclusive rights to casino gambling. And if those exclusivity agreements are violated, then Connecticut loses out on its share of slot machine revenues at the two states' casinos, Foxwoods and Mohegan Sun. So that's a big deal. He's pretty confident that he's going to get something out. He wants it to take into account all different types of gambling, too, not just sports betting, but iGaming, some other things, lottery. So there's a chance that there may be some other entities that will offer sports betting in the long run, but the tribes are very particular on who those entities might be. They don't want somebody like, say, MGM coming in and offering sports betting.
Mm. Dave, there's an effort, isn't there, to bring casino gambling to the New York City area?
Yeah, some of the major players in Las Vegas are trying to open up the New York City area sooner than initially agreed upon, and they're floating these $500 million license fees as an incentive for lawmakers and Governor Andrew Cuomo to change New York's law so that they can have casinos there prior to 2023.
Dave, to stay with you, vaping products, they just put a 20% tax?
There's a new 20% tax on all vape products that was included in the budget. And, you know, this is one of the fun examples of things where this should probably be used to help, you know, fund tobacco control efforts, to curb smoking efforts. But there hasn't been an increase in the state budget on those types of efforts. So this money is just going to the general fund to fund other obligations.
Sue, the sugary drink tax in Connecticut.
That's something they're talking about. It's something actually that the governor's proposing. He wants 1.5 cents per ounce. Again, it's another thing we're not sure if it's going to fly or not. The industry is fighting very hard against it. In the past, these things have really been more successful in big cities and not necessarily states. So that's to be determined. And his argument is he wants to try to reduce consumption to improve health outcomes and reduce diabetes and obesity, things like that.
So this is one where when we say, okay, is the state doing the right thing? The governor is saying we are trying to do the right thing. We're trying to discourage. But later on in the program, we'll have a number of guests to talk about whether or not that actually does work. So I hope everyone stays with us for that. Dave, coming back to you, in New York State, there's a higher tax on alcohol nowadays.
Well, there's talk of doubling New York's alcohol taxes to fund alcohol addiction services. This would double existing rates. It'd be worth 3 cents on a 12-ounce beer, 2 cents on a glass of wine. This is something that has almost no traction, but it's definitely an interesting talking point. It's up there with some of the efforts to legalize prostitution, which has gotten some support from Senate Democrats who really want to decriminalize. So there's no real interest in making money off it, but they want to remove the criminal aspect for sex workers.
And I read quickly online about some of this in terms of decriminalizing prostitution, because some argue this is just the beginning of the effort to legalize it. Have you heard anything about that?
I mean, yes, that's been a conversation. It's been almost solely committed to New York City, where this is a bigger issue. And they want to take this as a holistic, sort of comprehensive approach that addresses sex trafficking, homelessness, sexual abuse, and the whole gamut of issues. And then, you know, tucked into that, you know, you might have to be some sort of legalization of prostitution.
So when you talk to some of the political leaders in Hartford, and does the topic of morals ever come up for what the state is doing? Or are they simply looking at this nowadays and saying, look, we're broke, we need the money, let's see what we can get from some of these taxes and maybe possibly try to change a behavior or two?
It's more of the latter. They see a lot of these things as a way to influence behavior. They know that there's money out there, especially with the sports betting. They think there's a good shot at us getting some more cash. But on the other issues, like say the, you know, we have a proposal for a wine bottle tax, and it's not necessarily to discourage people from drinking wine, but they're trying to get discourage them from throwing wine bottles outside or nip bottles. They want to add a 5 cent per bottle tax on little nip bottles because there's too many of them on the sides of the road. So a lot of it is trying to influence behavior, and I think that's interesting.
And I'm sorry, you said there was also talk of 25 cents on liquor and wine bottles?
25 cent deposit they want to add to liquor and wine bottles. Yep,
and
that's something the governor's proposed.
And 5 cents on the nips. And Dave, to finally wrap it up, opioid tax.
Yeah, so this was included in the budget last year. It was struck down because of language that said the tax, the cost of the tax, couldn't be passed on to consumers. This time around, the budget language explicitly says you can pass this cost on to consumers. It's expected to generate $100 million in new revenue. And again, this is an issue where it doesn't come with an additional $100 million in opioid addiction services. There's some commitment for it, but nothing written into the law. So this money could just end up funding other budget priorities.
Just goes straight into the general fund. Dave Lombardo, Albany Times Union. Sue Haig, Associated Press up in Hartford. Sue, Dave, always a pleasure. We thank you for your time.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you, Sue. You too. Thank you, Dave. We are talking about morals today and what's going on in our region in Connecticut and New York, and we hope you join in the conversation. We have a number of very, very interesting guests coming up for you. I hope you stay with us. If you'd like to join in, tfs@wshu.org. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back. It's the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. 20 seconds to tell you about tomorrow's program. If you're a boomer, if you're of that generation, tomorrow's program, quite frankly, is aimed at you. There are numerous reports nowadays that say boomers, even though years ago they said, you know, we were going to be better than our parents, we're going to lead better lives, and we're going to be healthier and smarter as we got older. There are so many boomers suffering from depression nowadays. Unfortunately, the suicide rate appears to be up also, and they're self-medicating. We're talking about taking prescription drugs or possibly something illegal, and it's a concern, and the boomers are simply living longer. We're going to have a number of experts tomorrow talk about that, and if you're a boomer or if you're someone who is taking care of someone from that generation, we would love to hear from you. Please email us, tfs@wshu.org. And we will put your comments on the air. Speaking about comments, today we're talking about morality in our region. And I want to just start off this section by reading an email that we got in from Rosemary. She wrote in, politicians who are endorsing these activities are looking to make money from the sale. She's talking about actually marijuana in Connecticut. But at what cost to the communities and the state? These same politicians will try telling us how much they care about the people, but they are really concerned about the money they can generate from the sale of illegal drugs. The taxes are going to drive me out, along with the terribly misguided decisions our elected officials keep making. Connecticut needs to get spending under control before getting involved in the illegal drug trade, adding tolls, and taxing the working people even more. If you want to send us your comments, tfs@wshu.org. Three guests are joining us now. Professor Brian Stiltner is professor of philosophy, theology, and religious studies and co-director of the Hersher Institute for Applied Ethics at Sacred Heart University. Professor, always good to see you.
Thank you, Ron. Good to be here.
Professor Lauren Gonzalez is joining us on the phone, assistant professor of psychology at Adelphi University. Professor, thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And Professor Peter Descholy is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Stony Brook University. Professor Descholy, thank you, sir.
Hi, Ron. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. It's our pleasure. Professor Descholy, I'd like to start with you. What's your take on the morality question from the political viewpoint? So legislators are debating or they're enacting laws that a few years back wouldn't have even been considered. Are the politicians simply reflecting their constituencies or are they looking at it from a practical business perspective?
Right. So let me tell you a little bit about my background. So my PhD is actually in psychology, and I'm an expert in moral psychology. So whenever someone thinks something's immoral or unfair, I'm very interested, and I try to figure out what factors, what elements of that make it more or less perceived as more or less immoral. So when it comes to politics and policies, whenever a policy comes up and some people think it's fair or not, or also if, in this case with respect to the underlying behaviors, things like gambling, marijuana use, and so on, so people's judgments about those, that's the particular focus that that I have. So for your question, my thoughts about it would, I'm not so much an expert in what the politicians are thinking at the moment, but what I find interesting about it is how people's judgments of the policy depend on the intentions. And so as the example that you started out with, that this person thinks if the intention is to grab a bunch of money, then that doesn't seem well intentioned. So that's kind of where my interest would be is, what if the intention is something else, like to deter the behavior and other things that we could think of, then how would that change this person's view? So that's the perspective that I come at it from.
So with that in mind and with that background, and when you hear and see everything that is being debated nowadays in New York State and Connecticut, obviously a lot of legislation and the money from what was once considered to be vices or immoral, and those will be going into the state coffers. How do you perceive this?
To me, it's just very interesting because I get to see people debate these things, and I get to see the thought processes, behind them on either side. I think because I study this thing from a scientific perspective, I often don't have too many strong feelings myself, especially because I end up being able to see it from, from many different perspectives. I'm just sort of watching with interest, I would say.
Professor Stiltner, same question for you. Again, thanks for being here. How do you perceive what is going on with the state governments?
Right. Well, so like Peter, as an ethicist and political philosopher, I'm also interested in kind of the rationales behind, say, what Rosemary said. And I appreciated her email to start us off. And what I notice in there is kind of an inherent tension behind that the idea of the taxes that go along with legalizing something like prostitution or marijuana use, she used the word illegal, and I think she really meant immoral, drug use is immoral. And it makes sense that we think about whether we legalize and tax something as giving a kind of condoning as a society. That should be part of the thinking. And then she also said the taxes are going to drive me out. So she's also just concerned, understandably, about taxes in overall in general. But there is kind of an interesting kind of tension there, because if she's not doing those activities like gambling and marijuana use, it seems like maybe if she's concerned about lower taxes, she should want the vice taxes, because that will tax people who are doing the wrong things. But all of us in trying to approach this, I think we have a lot of tensions, almost some kind of conceptual confusions how we think about it. I certainly think the politicians do. I agree with Rosemary that mostly what it's all about, and your reporters confirm this, is just trying to get money and find ways to stop gaps. And we go to sin or vice taxes because it's a little bit, there's some kind of social opprobrium around them, or maybe the people want to do them so much they won't speak up too much and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, my position, my general position as I approach this is that it's okay to have some kind, we got to tax something as a society, and we need to make public choices about it. And taxes always play some kind of pedagogical role. They say what some of our basic values should be, for instance, in the reporting about not littering. That's a bigger value now than just, sort of using marijuana in general. So we can, use some of our taxing policy to try to steer socially beneficial behaviors as we see them now. But as is often with politics, I think we don't really approach it with a sense of like, what's a good overall policy as opposed to stopgap measures. It's not about lower taxes or just finding money for me, but about what's a fairer, more civic-minded tax policy that we all agree on. But that's optimistic to say.
You are an optimist. Yeah. that's excellent to hear. Professor Lauren Gonzalez, Assistant Professor of Psychology at Adelphi University. I have a bit of a different question for you, Professor. It's When I was talking with the two reporters before, at the beginning of the program, and they were saying that some of the politicians are enacting these taxes because they're trying to change behavior. From the psychological standpoint, does that work?
Yeah, so it seems like, and I agree with them, the idea behind these taxes seem to be that the higher tax will motivate behavior change by, you know, either deterring people from buying the substance in the first place or reducing their use if they're already using. And so, you know, if we take the soda taxes, for example, in some of the cities that have implemented this, we see that there's a decrease in buying patterns as a result of these higher taxes. But there hasn't been any consistent evidence, at least so far, of any health benefits associated with this. So this kind of presents the question of, you know, if the price of one substance is higher, are people actually stopping that behavior, or might they just be, you know, engaging in finding a substitute behavior? Mm. And maybe that substitute isn't necessarily going to be healthier.
So in other words, if I'm not going to buy a Big Gulp, maybe I'm going to switch over to the other aisle and I'm going to buy a bunch of Twinkies.
Right, exactly. And then the other thing I think about as a clinical psychologist is the idea of addiction, right? So we call these substance use disorders, commonly thought of as addiction disorders. But although many people might use or engage in the behavior, only a portion will become addicted in the sense that their use would significantly interfere with their lives. So for this portion of the population who's engaging in this behavior, the higher tax might not actually be enough to deter them from using, because by that point, if they have the addiction, the rewards of using and the cost of discontinuing the use are really too strong by that point for them.
Professor Gonzalez, from your point of view, do you have conversations with friends or colleagues nowadays about the moral direction that our society seems to be taking nowadays? And are there any concerns about it? Or do they feel, you know what, this is how we're evolving, and it's okay, because we're going in this direction. Let's somehow deal with it.
Right, and this is actually a particular interest of mine. So I look at social factors related to recovery for people diagnosed with mental illness, and this includes a lot about stigma and discrimination and other social disadvantages. So we know that people with, you know, what we think of as the more severe mental illnesses like schizophrenia experience higher rates of homelessness, poverty, and medical problems. They also experience higher rates of co-occurring substance use disorders. So when we think about something like sin or vice taxes, I think about how the implementation will actually influence these individuals who are already disadvantaged. I also think, you know, thinking about the moral side of things, it's easier for us to consider sin taxes as beneficial from more of a paternalistic perspective, because there's almost an inherent stigma associated with the behavior, right? Mm. It's called a sin tax. It's right there in the name. And as a society, you know, we're trying to move away from this, but we still tend to think of addiction as a moral failure. So this puts people with the problematic use patterns into a stigmatized group. We might consider them lesser than the rest of society, and then we might be more likely to consider methods of punishing or controlling their behavior as opposed to helping them to get better.
Professor Stiltner, when as an ethicist, as someone who is the co-director of the Hersher Institute for Applied Ethics at Sacred Heart University, when you hear that the state of Connecticut and the state of New York are thinking about or some are trying to legalize marijuana, what does the ethical side of you think about this?
Well, just like the conversation you're having here, I think when you're thinking about ethics in this day and age, and when you're doing it from a university standpoint, it should be about bringing together interdisciplinary resources and good, you know, critical thinking, as opposed to just moralizing. So I'm no fan of even the term syntax, mm-hmm. And I think that we have to, what I want to do ethically is begin to think about all these ramifications we're talking about now, including possible regressive burdens on already populations who are already struggling, and what really is most effective for people's well-being and for public health. Marijuana, I'm still, of all the issues we're talking about today that could have these kind of discouraging taxes, that one is the one I'm really still, like all of Connecticut and all the nation, trying to think about and learn about. I don't feel, you know, like most people, the great moral stigma against it anymore. I can see sort of the idea of, like, yeah, it's kind of popular, and it's, we're kind of moving as a society from thinking about it more in the realm of tobacco to more mm-hmm. in the realm of alcohol, where if you can use it responsibly, it doesn't have, but it's still something that most people use by smoking. There's both kind of lung kinds of issues, and I'm really concerned with what the medical societies bring out in terms of early teenage use. And, you know, we'll put all these things around and say, well, you have to be 21 and you can't use and drive. But as with alcohol and everything else, it's easy to set those rules and there will always be some violations of it. And since the law plays a kind of a teaching purpose, when it goes from being illegal to legalized and taxed and able to buy in your local corner store, you can say, kids, you should wait until you're 21 or 25 until your brain starts to develop. But that's not what's going to happen. Kids already use. So that's my biggest worry about the ethics of the public health for developing brains of our younger citizens.
It's how many times have we said, kids, don't drink that beer until you're 21.
Right.
Does that work? No, it doesn't. Professor DeSciulli, I'd like to, while we have just a few minutes left, can we talk a little bit about casinos and gambling? If from your readings, from your studies, from your research, Do you feel that this is appropriate for our region? And if it's going to happen, you might as well do it the right way. And look, if it's going to happen, put it in New York City. And that's where the tourists are.
Well, I should first confess I haven't thought very much specifically about gambling. But I did look up just a couple of these things recently in for this, and it looks like most Americans do not think gambling is immoral. It's about 24% in the most recent poll that I saw. And for that matter, we could go back to the marijuana case, and most Americans don't think smoking marijuana is immoral. It's just under half that think it is. And so we can raise this question of morality is something that people disagree on, that there's a lot of variation about. And that brings up a very difficult problem for society, which is when we disagree on morality, which has a lot of consequences, especially because when people think something's immoral, they want to punish the people that are doing it. So there's, you know, a lot behind these disagreements. When we do disagree, whose morality should govern the laws, or should morality, you know, not really be too involved in laws? Should we focus more on what the effects of policies are, and take more of a sort of a utilitarian perspective that tries to be relatively neutral, especially about morals that are very divisive and that people disagree about. So the gambling would raise that question as well. And I think that is part of this discussion is trying to figure out, you know, should society be taking a stand on moral issues that there isn't consensus about, or that most people are going, you know, don't think is immoral, which would be the case for both gambling and marijuana.
Professor Gonzalez, I have about a minute and a half left in this segment, and I'd like to finish it up with you and Professor Stilton for some quick thoughts on this. 35 years ago, I did programs, talk shows with representatives for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. And they were saying pot is going to be legal in our lifetimes. And I said, you guys are smoking way too much of your own product. There's no way that's going to happen. And here it is. It's they were absolutely right. I was absolutely wrong. Is this simply the direction that we're taking nowadays? Things are just becoming more liberal, more, I don't want to use the word democratic, but I think you know what I'm trying to say. Professor Gonzalez, I want to start with you. Quick thoughts, 30, 45 seconds, please. And then Professor Stilton, I'll end with you.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say we're becoming more liberal, you know, as a society. I think, you know, as we learn more about specific substances, we become more open to, you know, finding out more and maybe making a profit off of those substances eventually. But, you know, the big problem I want to bring up here is the potential conflict of interest as well. So, you know, if the government is making money off of a particular substance and the goal is to, you know, lead to behavior change, what happens if that goal is achieved, right? The government will lose out on that source of income. So I think that's something that we also need to be keeping in mind, whether we're becoming more liberal or not, you know, where is this money actually going and what are we using it for?
Professor Stiltner.
And I would agree with what Dr. Gonzalez said. And so I think it's not that we become less moral, but definitely what becomes important for public morals does shift. We kind of shifted away from looking at gambling and dancing and drinking in certain ways. And environmental issues are the bigger thing.
Well, at one point, dirty dancing was immoral.
That's right. And I think the mention by Peter of utilitarian, you know, we do need to kind of have sort of a way of kind of thinking, following our following the data, trying to think about what's most important for impacts on public health, acknowledging our agreements to disagree. I think smoking and the stigmatization of that and the education and taxes are part of that has been a big public health boon. And not every issue is going to, even marijuana is going to be as clear as that. But that's going to be kind of our gold standard. And I think everything else short of that, we're going to be fighting about for a while.
Professor Brian Stiltner, Professor Lauren Gonzalez, Professor Peter Descholle, thank you all. It was a pleasure having you here. Professor Gonzalez, Professor Descholle, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
It's The Full Story on WSHU. We'll take a short break. We'll be right back. If you'd like to join in the conversation, we are always looking for your thoughts, your comments, questions. Email us, tfs@wshu.org, or you can follow us on Twitter. We're at FullStoryWSHU. This is The Full Story on WSHU and online at wshu.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. It's an interesting discussion that we're having today. I guess it always is when you're talking about beliefs and morals and practical applications and how they change depending on the circumstance. Sometimes I think of that old line, there are no atheists in the foxholes. And conversely, does a higher power or morals get consideration when tax revenue is needed? Three more guests for the remainder of our program today. Dr. Thomas Babor is addiction researcher and professor in the Department of Community Medicine at the UConn School of Medicine. He's the co-author of Setting Limits, Gambling Science, and Public Policy. Professor, thank you for being with us today.
Good to be here.
Art Mangello is Manager of Policy and Communications at the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling. Art, thanks again for being with us.
Hi, Ron. Thanks for having me.
And Steve Chastman is Executive Director of the Long Island Council on Alcohol and Drug Dependence. Steve, we appreciate your time.
No, good afternoon. It's a great forum.
Dr. Babor, there's a push in our region, as you know, for more casinos, sports betting, and obviously we're always seeing commercials to spend more money on the lottery. Does this concern you in any way?
It does, and I think it sends the wrong message to the public that revenues are more important than people's personal problems and the cost to society. Gambling has enormous hidden costs which impact everybody, not just the gambler. And multiplication of opportunities to gamble is only going to exacerbate the problems that we've already observed.
But Dr. Babor, and I heard this argument many, many years ago, and I know you've heard it too, politicians will tell you, look, if we don't do it, they're going to go underground and gambling will still take place in the communities. So let's legalize it and then let's use the money for some good in other ways.
Yeah, that's a persuasive argument, but to look back 20 or 30 years ago, how many people did you know who had gambling problems? I think it's a question of how we provide people with recreational opportunities without giving them an incentive to develop a pathological addiction.
Art Mangello is Manager of Policy and Communications at the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling. Art, have we gone too far?
Well, acknowledging that approximately 97% of the population can actually gamble without having manifesting a gambling problem, we have to make sure that we're taking care of that 3% of folks in Connecticut that do manifest a gambling problem and the 2% that actually meet clinical criteria for a gambling disorder. Now, we're talking about 35,000 people. Now, if you layer on the fact that each problem gambler negatively impacts up to 9 people in their lives, those people being spouses, parents, children, employers, friends, et cetera, that number grows to 315,000, and that's approaching epidemic proportions.
And what could be done or should be done to stop this?
I think that any expansion of legalized gambling, be it through sports betting, new casinos, or online gambling in Connecticut, is obviously going to increase participation and problems unless we take certain steps to sort of strengthen the safety net. and that would include ensuring that any expansions include dedicated funding for prevention, treatment, and recovery services, requiring any sports betting operators to implement responsible gaming programs, assigning a strong regulatory agency to ensure that regulations and requirements are enacted responsibly, and establishing a consistent minimum age for sports gambling and fantasy games as well, because you'll find that it's sort of all across the board. Some are 21, some are 18. And finally, we want to make sure that we conduct surveys of the prevalence of gambling addiction prior to expansion and at regular periods thereafter so that we can monitor the impact and have data that will support evidence-based mitigation efforts.
Art, but I have to be honest with you. Following the news as I do, I hear a lot of talk about casinos being built in East Windsor, expansion possibly in Bridgeport. I hear the talk about that, but I haven't read or heard anything about programs to enhance the to help those with gambling problems and addictions.
Right, and so that we've testified at the public hearings up at the state capitol, and we want to make sure that those five responsible gaming principles that I just mentioned are built into any legislation. We do have programs available statewide, but there are large gaps in coverage. So certain folks living in North Central Connecticut, for example, have to drive a little ways to get services, and we all know that's a barrier to treatment.
Dr. Babor, you may have heard our conversation a little bit earlier in the show. There's consideration in Albany right now to possibly put casinos in New York City or the New York City region. What do you think when you hear that?
Well, again, the more convenient and accessible you make a gambling product, in this case casino games, the more likely it is that people, particularly people who live close to it, are going to take advantage of it. And then it becomes a question of how addictive the games are. And slot machines are the ones that generate the biggest profit. There are many incentives that are now being built into these machines that increase time on machine. Slot machines have been called the crack cocaine of gambling. Mm. And the more that these products are available, the more problems you're going to have to deal with.
Steve Chasman is the executive director of the Long Island Council on Alcohol and Drug Dependence. And Steve, I'm so happy that you're with us today. I mean, I do want to talk about alcohol and drugs, but I also want to talk about gambling and get your perspective on this, because from what I've been told in the past, when Dr. Babor says, you know, crack cocaine and slot machines, I can recall being in Vegas and seeing people sitting in front of the slot machines for hours and not moving, not just with those big buckets of coins and not moving. And I'm assuming that same portion of the brain that says, give me more alcohol, give me more drugs, that's what's doing it for that too.
Oh, absolutely. You're talking about dopamine surges, and all the panelists accomplished as we work in our fields. We're dealing with self-medication, whether you're moving from marijuana to alcohol to opiates to legalized gambling to, digital online gaming, even to the lottery. I've been in the field, as many of your panelists have, for 25 years, and when they legalized gambling in New York State, there was supposed to be monies allotted for this very progressive illness called gambling obsession, which not only destroys an individual life, but that of the family and the community as well. And as New York State gears up for legalizing marijuana, we are not yet fully comprehending what the opiate epidemic was about. And why so many Long Islanders, so many New Englanders, so many Americans are turning to pills, powders, potions, and we've heard it on Long Island as paper crack, scratch-off tickets, that are turning towards synthetic vices for self-medication at a rate we've never before seen. And it's not just squandering the family resources. You're talking about a very progressive and destructive diseases that are actually featured in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Disorder. So I think it's more of an existential question for each state and for America. You know, do we want to profitize You know, these quote unquote vices or self-medications that are clearly detrimental to an individual, family, and community health. The billions of dollars in revenue potentially from gambling, from alcohol sales, from taxation, from states, from marijuana. You know, is it really being filtered towards community education and treatment? My experience in 25 years, and some of the other panelists can weigh in, is that state capitals love to say they're going to earmark money for community education and treatment. Meanwhile, we have not seen that. And, you know, they just opened a 24-hour gambling center right here on the Long Island Expressway, and there was supposed to be monies allotted for community education and billboards, and we just haven't seen the promise. And quite frankly, one of the fights that LICAD and a host of other treatment advocates have been involved in is access to treatment for substance use disorders, where you have insurance companies still fighting because they have a fiduciary interest to deny treatment. It's been a very long, hard 10-year fight. And last year in America, as we know, there were 72,000 opioid deaths and there were 88,000 alcohol-related fatalities. So whether you're talking about prescription medication, and let's not forget about the benzos like Xanax and Clonopin and Valium, you're talking about legal self-medications that are not only destroying lives, but literally taking the lives of Long Islanders, New Englanders, and Americans at a rate we've never before seen.
So, Steve, are we trending in the right, in the wrong direction nowadays? And when you speak with legislators and the politicians, what are they telling you?
Well, listen, you know, the projected revenue for the first year of legal marijuana in New York State is $600 million. Now, although it hasn't officially, and Governor Cuomo did take it out of this year's budget because there was significant pushback, as all 62 counties in New York State have been impacted by the recent substance use crisis, and there's been tangible loss. But I don't think as a country or as a society we can have it both ways. You can't generate hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in tax revenue trying to regulate some form of self-medication and not equally provide community education, prevention, and access to treatment. Now, not to look outside of our great nation, but other countries have used the model a little differently with the decriminalization of drugs, taking a lot of the power out of cartels and street gangs, filtering it into education and access to treatment. So I think, and we went through this in the 1920s with the Prohibition Movement and the Volstead Act. Do we give people what they want, despite its detriment to individual, family, and community health? Or do we actually regulate it, but filter some of the money that's generated towards a greater understanding and access to treatment?
Art Mongillo is with us, the manager of policy and communications at the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling. Art, when you go to Hartford and you're asking the legislators for support and telling them about the extent of the problem, and you mentioned a massive number before, the number of lives that it affects in Connecticut, and I believe it was more than 300,000?
315,000.
315,000. Are they aware of the situation and the effects, the horrible effects that it takes on the families?
I found it somewhat amusing that we testified at the state capitol and we spent 11 hours there one day. We were the very last folks to testify before the public safety committee. And all day long, we heard industry folks and municipal folks coming up and talking about all the benefits and specifically the financial benefits. And so it's somewhat ironic that the last voices heard that day were about the dangers of problem gambling. And obviously, in speaking with individual legislators, they all agree that there is a danger there and that there needs to be some form of support. Unfortunately, there is a bill before the legislature. It is Senate Bill 1014, which is an act concerning funding for compulsive gambling treatment and rehabilitation. An original iteration that we saw of that bill had 25% of new monies coming in from expanded gambling being dedicated to prevention and treatment. That number, when it was finally passed out of committee, was reduced to 2%.
These are hard statistics to hear. But and Art, I have to share something with you. I was talking with a friend last night on the phone, and he was asking about the program we were doing today. And I was telling him about the moral aspects of it. And he started to laugh, and he said, "Are you kidding? Nobody talks about this stuff anymore. Get with the times." And that's exactly what he said.
Yeah, I think that, you know, Connecticut, obviously, with the economy being what it is really looking for sort of that magic bullet to sort of restore everything. And we're talking about legalized marijuana now. We're talking about tolls, and now we're talking about expanded gambling. And I don't think enough thought is given to perhaps the dark side of that, the downside of that, because it really only impacts a small segment of the population. And as I said, when we talk about 3% of Connecticut residents, it doesn't seem like a lot on the surface. So what we try to communicate to them is the larger ripple effect impact, as well as the actual number of folks that really can be devastated by this.
So, Dr. Babor, how do we get the leaders, those in state governments and our moral leaders, to think more about the dark side?
Yeah, well, I think personal stories are important, and also a little bit of common sense. When you take alcohol, we've found from recent estimates by health economists that it cost American society about $250 billion. That comes down to about $2 a drink that somebody is paying for all the accidents, the industry, the accidents, the injuries, the trauma that families experience having an alcoholic, the birth defects, it goes on and on, cancer, liver cirrhosis, on and on and on. Now, about 40% of the costs of binge drinking are borne by governments. So we need to understand that making products more affordable, putting them into the hands of commercial entities that can encourage people to use more of the product, making them more convenient, all of these things have cost to society. And if governments want to cut down on healthcare costs and make society better for everybody, then these behaviors linked to addictive substances and products, they need to be made less affordable and less convenient. And health taxes on gambling and alcohol and tobacco, we've seen the benefits of raising taxes on tobacco. And eventually it'll get down to a level where we might be able to eliminate what was previously an epidemic that almost affected 50% of American adults. So we have tools that can be applied to reverse epidemics, and what we're doing now is not using those tools. We're putting into effect certain kinds of policies, like expanding gambling or allowing, not letting alcohol taxes to increase with inflation. We're using policies to encourage people in behaviors that are unhealthy and not good for society.
Steve Chasman, I have about 45 seconds left. You get to have the last word today, please.
Well, I mean, listen, I wish we had more dialogues centering around ethics and morality, not only as communities, as a society at whole. You know, is it ethical or is it moral to really gain capital at the risk of the individual, family, and community health? The data is all in. We know some of the data around gambling. We know some of the data around alcohol and or other drugs, alcohol being the most deadly drug in America, has been, continues to be. We know some of the dangers coming out with legalization of marijuana, and there were ways to decriminalize it. But it seems like more and more states are interested in tax revenue. So ultimately, and here's an ethical question. You know, do we want to look at capital gains, or do we want to look at the health and wellness of our citizens?
Steve, I have
the answer can be both, but we need to earmark significant portions of this tax revenue towards individual and community health.
Steve Chasman is executive director of the Long Island Council on Alcohol and Drug Dependence. Art Mongillo is manager of policy and communications at the Connecticut Council on Problem Gambling, and Professor Thomas Babor, addiction researcher and professor at UConn School of Medicine. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your time.
And a good day.
That's it for our show today. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.